Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
I started to just get antsy because I knew I wasn't happy where I was. Friends would say, I know your problem, you need to act again. I'd be like, shut up, you know.
This is Death, Sex, and Money.
Lay low for a while. You're probably wanted for murder.
The show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot.
I'm really not comfortable talking about sex.
And need to talk about more.
It's a question of money. Money's a good reason.
I'm Anna Sale. Fans of the TV series Veep know Anna Klumsky as Amy, the neurotic top aide to Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character, Selina Meyer.
Amy! Yeah. So what?
Nothing. Well, I've been on the phone all night with these clueless constitutional law experts of ours. I don't know what's getting their dicks harder, an electoral college tie or talking to a girl.
But Anna's current success, at age 35, came after years of not working as an actor. She became instantly famous at 10 years old when she co-starred in the movie My Girl, opposite Macaulay Culkin.
Maiden, her little boyfriend.
He is not my boyfriend. I bet you kissed him on the lips.
Do you think I kissed that ugly old thing?
You were not nervous as a kid. It was, can you do this? Yeah, I can. So it just worked, and it was something that I was good at and that, pleased the adults, which is all you're trying to do as a kid.
As a girl, do you remember wanting to be in movies?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't choose it. This was all kind of more of a financial situation that ballooned because it was first, like, modeling for the catalogs. And then and my mom figured that that was a good way to put away money for college because she was a single mom and, you know, West Side Chicago, how are we going to do, you know, an opportunity is an opportunity.
After My Girl, Anna kept auditioning for parts and she got a few roles here and there. But when she was a teenager, her career started to fizzle out.
It just makes you feel like shit. As an adolescent, most rejections as an adolescent for anybody in any walk of life, those make you feel like shit over and over.
When things got hard in your career in your later teen years, did it become difficult with your mom?
Yeah, you know, but, you know, I look back. And I go, she did absolutely, you know, maybe aside from like a few things, everything right. You know, we never left Chicago. Like we stayed in school. Like we always knew that everything I earned was for college. However, unfortunately, what ends up happening, even if you're trying to do everything right, you know, when the child is earning and it does start to pay for the mortgage, the dynamics just change. And, you know, so I think she, you know, who could see that coming, really? But yeah, it's, I think no one can kind of like go through a professional childhood unscathed.
Did you feel different from your peers when you're in high school because you'd been in movies?
I mean, I don't think I would have had they not thought I was different. But it was just a lot. You know, people were like, why aren't you showing up to school in a limo? You know, and you're like, because I live two blocks from you and you know how much those houses cost. Like, we have, like, stop it. You know, like, I'm not, you know, rich, or I'm not this, or I'm not that. There was, it was a lot of, yeah, just like, you know, not just trying to get people to know you, but first breaking down what people thought they knew about you. Being the kid in the movie then becomes like the label, and people change, and, you know, some people want to be your friends who never wanted to before. Family members are weird. So I became very private and not terribly trusting of people. And, you know, that's something I kind of struggle with to this day.
Do you remember the moment when you decided you wanted to stop acting?
Yeah. I went into my agents to do yet another taped audition for something that I knew I wouldn't get, because it was in a slew. It was in a huge pattern of jobs I wasn't getting, like, years. And so I did it, and I got in my little – I had a neon, a Dodge Neon, and I threw the script on the passenger's side, on the seat. And I don't know. It's one of those detached moments where it's like I just looked at the script and I went, I don't have to do this anymore.
That was during Anna's freshman year of college. She decided to buckle down and focus on her studies at the University of Chicago.
Famous for a slogan, where fun comes to die.
She paid for college with money she'd earned as a kid. And at the end of her sophomore year, she started dating a freshman named Sean So.
Did he know who you were?
Yeah. Everybody, you know, knew that I was the girl for My Girl and stuff. But the nice thing is he didn't care. He didn't really grow up watching movies very voraciously. And by then, I could tell who cared and who didn't. You know what I mean? So, like, you kind of feel safe with the people who don't care.
Anna and Sean were together throughout college. And when she graduated a year before he did, she decided to move to New York.
What was the plan? What was your vision?
Oh, my plan was to write food and travel articles so that my job could pay for the thing I liked the most, which was travel and eat.
Smart.
Yeah, but I had no clips, you know, leaving college. Like, I never wrote for the paper. You know, I never, like, that's not something I did during college. So it's like, oh, okay, this is what you're going to do. But I actually sold a couple, like, this is when, like, internet articles were just beginning to pay. And, you know, so I think I sold, like, two different articles for, like, $35, one on Ovaltine.
You wrote an article about Ovaltine?
Yes.
Was it in praise or in critique?
Oh, praise only. I love Ovaltine.
Anna eventually got a job as an editorial assistant for HarperCollins, but the prospect of acting again haunted her.
You know, when I first got to New York, I saw Mercedes Rule in The Goat, and I had this, like, completely impulsive act when I stood up for the ovation at the end where I went, I have to do that. I said it out loud. My mother heard me. My mother of all people, like, the person who wants me to be in showbiz more than I, you know, like, I would never say this rationally, you know? I'm like, oh, no, she heard me.
Coming up, how Anna decided to try acting again just after her boyfriend Sean enlisted in the military.
And then I said to him, I was like, what would you say if I started auditioning again and tried to act again? And he's like, I cannot be in training for the Army right now and tell you not to take a risk with your life.
Hi, guys. This is Chester Jesus Soria. I'm a producer with Death, Sex, and Money. Anna's still out on maternity leave with baby June. You can read more about their adventures out west by subscribing to our newsletter at deathsexmoney.org/newsletter. And one of our most recent newsletters also had updates from folks we interviewed last year in our episode called Siblinghood. If you haven't heard that episode, you can still listen to it at deathsexmoney.org. Shortly after that episode came out, we actually got a voice memo from a listener named Edel in Texas who wanted to share her own story.
It's not about my siblings. It's actually about my relationship with my friends that I grew up with. This relationship with these girls was literally a life-altering friendship.
Idel says she fell out of touch with those friends, enough so that she didn't invite them to her wedding, and they weren't really talking when she moved to a new country.
When your sibling conversation talked about the breakup of family relationships, it reminded me of the breakup of my friendship relationships. It took me a long, long time to make my peace with that breakup. It really, really did.
Her voice memo prompted us to look through our inbox for other stories about breakups. And last year, we got an email from a listener named Rachel. She wrote us about 2 weeks after her boyfriend moved out of their apartment. She described their time together as the best 3 years of her life. And she said, quote, "It's scary to imagine not having that and having to meet someone new. Plus, where do you put all that love that you gave that person?" Since she wrote us, Rachel's met somebody new, and she told us that she's very happy right now. Still, she says, hearing other people's stories about their breakups could have helped her. So that's what we're asking for today. We want to hear your stories about your breakups, romantic, friendship, family, or otherwise. If you want to share your story, just email us, or record a voice memo on your smartphone, and send that in to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. We'll be in touch before we use anything that you send us. On the next episode, our Night with Radio show selected shorts. Hear two of your favorite short stories about death, sex, and money, read by special guests like actress Kathleen Chalfont.
Until the girl died, that was enough for me. To be married to a fantastic man who loved me and was prone, once in a long while, to a little lapse and a lot of Catholic guilt about it.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before. Or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks. This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. As Anna Klumsky was navigating through her first few years in New York, her boyfriend Sean moved to Washington. It was 2003. The U.S. had just invaded Iraq, and he got a job at the Pentagon.
Basically, what he was doing at the Pentagon was analyzing. He was an analyst. And so he's drawing all these conclusions about what's a threat, what's not a threat. And he's going, I'm making decisions about boots on the ground, and I've never been on the ground. So he just kind of felt like he needed cred. So, yeah, he enlisted in the Army Reserve.
What was that conversation like between you?
Very, very akin to a lot of our major conversations to date, which is basically like, I will support you. There, you know, I can't not support your this decision. And, you know, yet I'm scared. And tell me how this is going to work. What will this be like? I mean, I wasn't crazy about the notion, of course, at first. But again, it's like, how can you, you know, how can you tell a person that they shouldn't volunteer and be of service and you know, be proud of themselves?
How soon after he enlisted did you find out he was going to be deployed?
I think like a year. There was, I remember the, I guess it was around the summer then of 2004 or 5, I don't remember, the Olympics were on and I was visiting my father. And I had a phone conversation with Sean where he kind of casually mentioned deployment, just the possibility of it. And I like freaked out because I had gotten into this habit of not thinking it would occur.
Yeah.
So yeah, then I got really sad because he's like, you know, I joined the military. He's like, you know, there's a war. Like, there will be a deployment someday. So then I had to start beefing myself up for that. And yeah, right around, I want to say the fall of that year, he got called. It was like the call. And then I cried. I had a friend staying with me. She was there. She saw me cry. But, you know, you go with it.
Around the same time, Anna was questioning the direction of her career from the sci-fi division at HarperCollins.
I don't know what it was about that week, but like there was a week where I was just crying a lot on my lunch break.
She told Sean how stuck she was feeling.
He was in Arizona doing advanced individual training. And
so he's just beginning his military training.
Yeah. And I told him about the day that this psychic followed me to work.
You have to tell me more about that.
So there's this psychic that was outside of HarperCollins that she, you know, she would just hand out her pamphlets. And I passed her. And then she's like, wait, I have a message for you. I'm like, yeah, you have a message for everybody. And she followed me. She left her little post, you know, taps me on the shoulder. And I'm like, yes. And she says, you're the girl for my girl. I'm like, no, you know, brainer. Like, thanks, psychic.
That's your big news.
Yeah, good for you. and so then she's like, but then she says, you're not done. You still want to do this. So that touched a nerve. So then the phone call that night is to my boyfriend then, Sean. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe I need to go to therapy because I obviously am so desperate for answers. And he's like, well, what would a therapist ask you that you don't already have the answer to?
Go, Sean.
I know. Right? Every once in a while, he's got a little nugget. And so then I, like, asked the question in my head, you know. You know, that led to, like, a little deep dive of, okay, I'll call the agent tomorrow because I still had an agent holding on to my headshots. And my agent then, you know, she was like, well, great. Go train. Go get some classes.
How long after the psychic did you quit your job?
I think this was in the course of like a week.
Really?
Yeah.
And this is like a job with benefits.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, it was benefits and I mean small salary. I mean it was assistant's salary, but
how'd you support yourself at
that
point?
That's when you dip into the savings.
This is money you earned as a kid?
Yep. Yep, that I had still had even after college. It wasn't a lot, but it was enough to get me through that first year, you know, barely. There were a couple really freaky months there, but.
I bet that's such a strange experience. You're like, you're looking at the balance of the money that you earned when you were a child.
Mm-hmm.
And you're watching it go down.
Yeah, yeah.
How much money was it after college?
I don't want to say, I guess, because
okay.
Then people are going to judge me.
I understand.
It was less than $50,000, okay?
Okay, tens of thousands of dollars.
Tens of thousands of dollars in savings.
Yeah. It was enough to get her through a year in New York and allow her to audition and focus on acting classes and not on the danger her boyfriend Sean was facing while he was deployed. He was in southern Afghanistan from 2004 to 2006. Was there anyone in your life who you could say, my boyfriend's in a war zone. This is what it feels like.
To an extent, I'm really bad at asking for help from my friends. I'm really bad at it. To this day, like, I can't think, I can probably count on my fingers how many times I've cried in front of a friend. I would tell people, like, you know, this is hard or this happened and I think it's because I'm missing Sean or, you know, but I definitely always tried to put a macho face on it for people. So, and for myself probably too.
How did communicating with your boyfriend first when he was in Washington and he's in training and then he's at war, how did having that distance change the way you communicated and your relationship?
You know, we really loved each other for young people, you know, and we didn't want to pretend that we didn't have emotions or fears or bad days or whatever. However, at the same token, I never wanted him to worry about me because I felt like that would take his eye off the prize and the prize being living. So I think we spoke with more care with one. We treat each other with care. While still being very pragmatic people, I think that that's also how we can handle it, you know?
So you're like trying to protect each other.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we reached a point where it was like a crossroads too, because we were young and we were like, well, is this going to be forever or is this not? Like, we had to have that conversation. And at that point, then it was like, I really do want you to be in my life. And I really do want you to be, you know, and then it was like, okay, we made our bed. No more wondering. No more, you know, is this the right thing to be doing at our age? Like, no, this is happening and we're together.
And you're both in your mid-20s
at
this point.
I know. We're both a little, I don't want to say mature for our age, but we are. I mean, both of us are kind of like that. I think that's something we both have in common, you know. Having grown up like with, you know, in divorced households and, you know, kind of being somewhat self-reliant and stuff like that, we both kind of were like ready to settle before many of our friends were.
When Sean got back, How long did it take you to be used to each other?
I mean, it didn't, not too long. I mean, given the circumstances, we kind of knew that there were like, there's this transition period where you're like, get out of my space. I'm glad to see you, but come on. But this is my stuff, you know? So we knew not to pressure ourselves too much, to have some kind of, you know, to be completely like used to each other, right away. And so I think removing that pressure helps.
Deciding to get married, you said it was something that you both felt pretty clear on. But having both come from parents that had been divorced, was that something that you had to work through together or separately?
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, when he proposed, you know, I said yes. But then about a month later, I was like kind of freaking out about it. And I was like, you know, because his proposal was very basic. It was, will you marry me? I mean, there was no like, I tell friends now who like are getting ready to propose to their girlfriends. I'm like, imagine she asked you, why do you want to marry me, in your head before you do the speech? Because it is a proposal. Like this isn't, there isn't, you know, it's not a gift necessarily. This is a, hey, this is what I got to offer. This is what why I'm doing this.
Make your case.
Maybe a business plan. So about a month later, I was like, why do you want to marry me? And he explained, you know, from then on, I was like, oh, I'm game. I'm in this. And, you know, but then of course, yeah, you know, freak out. I still freak out. Like, you know, not having a template necessarily for success or for what you think success is, you know, there's a lot to be said for this whole, well, we're making our own template. Like, well, we're going to do it our way, whatever our way is, and we'll figure that out.
Anna and Sean have been married since 2008. They had a daughter, Penelope, in 2013, and they're expecting a second child this summer. They live in Brooklyn. Sean now runs a consulting firm. And when Veep is in production, Anna has to be in L.A. What was it like commuting from California back home
tiring.
When you've got a young child?
It was tiring. I missed her, but I mean, I missed her like crazy, but I mean, I miss her today. I mean, it's wonderful, but your heart aches. You love them so much. Like it, you ache. Ugh. Anyway, I kept calling it the mama bird commute because I was like, all right, I got to go catch the worm and then I will come back. But I got to catch the worm. Who's going to, like, come on. Sean feels the same way when he goes to the office. It's like, okay, like I got to go and catch the worm. And we'll come back and you will eat and you will be happy, you know? So, yeah, it helps to
I love
put
that.
In that term.
Yeah. Why have a second kid right now?
Because the powers that be want it, you know? I learned, you know, you can't really plan. You can have an idea, but... And I'll say that I had a miscarriage too. So like, you know, people don't talk about that enough,
but
it's okay. It's a weird thing to go through, but because it's like, it's, you know, we had something where it just didn't grow. So it was just the idea that we had the loss of, which is really strange, but you still go through it. And like I said, I found out that it's a lot more people go through it. Then we talk about it. And it's not even that we're hiding it. It's just that it's so effing uncomfortable to talk about because you just aren't happy about it, you know? But I did – you do learn that this is, like, kind of not up to you. Like, it's kind of is, but it's kind of not. There's other stuff at work.
That's Anna Klumsky. You can see her in season 5 of Veep on HBO. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios. The team includes Katie Bishop, Chester Jesus Soria, Emily Botine, Andrew Dunn, and Rick Kwan. Our interns are Carson Frame and Brandy Gonzalez. The Reverend John DeLore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. And we have a link to Anna Klumsky's 2003 article about Ovaltine on our website at deathsexmoney.org. She may have left food writing behind, but Ovaltine is still part of her life.
I gave it to my daughter for the first time the other day, and it actually made me, like, it made me, I don't know, it was one of the, it's almost like having your first Christmas with your toddler. I was like, and she liked it, so I'm like, oh, my daughter loves Ovaltine.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.